So when it all went so incredibly wrong, people felt betrayed. I really think there was a point when one, or maybe both of them, but certainly him, kind of went, whoa, 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 wait a second. How did we end up here? Whose idea was it to fucking get married? But by then, they'd been cast as husband and wife in the most popular early version of a reality show ever. So, in a way, they kind of lost their vote in the whole thing. I'll bet they spent more time together in front of the camera than they did when the cameras weren't around. Certainly the time in front was a lot more fun. So there you go. This was the dream, that elusive, fantabulous American dream. The dream where these two little ordinary anybodies from nowhere all of a sudden had everything, demonstrating perfectly what was not only possible in America, but what was great about it. Two poor kids who had just pulled themselves up by their bootstraps, meet, fall in love, have a few children, and boom, have a wonderful life. Cut to a million years later, and now one of those two children of that couple with their wonderful life was 21 and living in New York, and one day she was taking this cooking class from some Yugoslavian woman who felt that it was not only necessary, but important to tell her, I hate your father. He is not good. Very, very bad. Mean, mean man. Your mother, she is an angel. A good woman, yes? She shook her head emphatically and repeated, your father, him I hate. Also, the woman who is Elizabeth Taylor, no good. You cannot trust a lady like that. She made a spitting sound. It was as though she wasn't talking about real people, and certainly not real people who were related to me, and who maybe it might not be appropriate to speak about like that. You know how when people pass away, they leave instructions as to what to do with what remains? I believe they're referred to as wills, but then so is one of the two princes in Great Britain. True to form, my father continued to neglect his parental duties in death as he did in life. No last will and testament, no wishes or instructions on where he wished to be buried or however else his remains or possession should be disposed of, was found among his effects. This could be because essentially he left nothing behind, but I also think that having never done anything that could be misconstrued for some kind of responsible act, why start now? Why begin at the end? So, without any last wishes to guide us, Eddie's offspring, myself, Jolie and Tricia, Todd having chosen not to attend the division of my father's lack of spoils, descended on his little Berkeley cottage overlooking the bay. The nice thing about all this was that there was nothing for the three of us to fight over. Oh, there was a piano, an assortment of sheet music, a closet full of clothes that hadn't been worn in over a decade, a watch, and the one item ultimately worth coveting, my dad's diamond pinky ring that he'd worn for as long as any of us could remember. This famously flashy, multifaceted diamond ring was the one and only item that any of us wanted, and I thought it only fair-ish that since I was the main one of us to look after him in his declining years, this ring should go to me, and then eventually to my uniquely spectacular child. A few years prior to his final decline, I'd moved my dad from his San Francisco apartment, which was located on a hill directly across the street from Grace Cathedral, and reinstalled him in a little white house in the Berkeley Hills with a spectacular view of the bay and bridge, all of whose charms were, alas, lost to my ailing parent, whose gaze remained faithfully fixed on the iconic vistas of CNN. Eventually, I realized that I'd simply moved him from one bedroom on one side of the Bay Bridge to another bedroom on the other. But while he may not have been impressed with the view, he had become much more involved with me. Or was it me that had gotten more involved with him? The bottom line, one of the few my father failed to snort, is that we had both become increasingly involved with one another. Finally, and for the first time in our once strangely uninvolved lives. Somewhere along this line, I finally found that maybe I had to stop waiting around for him to give me something he probably didn't, at least not in any conventional sense, actually have to give. But what if that turned out to be enough? Or how about if it were more than I could have ever imagined getting? Especially given how low, bordering on non-existent, my expectations actually were. But there I was, looking after him, in those last however many years. I talked to his doctors, keeping in constant contact not only with him, but with his ever-changing, reliably constant rotation of Asian caregivers, who not only rolled his joints, changed his jammies, administered his medication and fed him his meals, but also routinely scrubbed the age lines that regularly creased his pale, worn skin, till it seemed to return to its former appearance of being both shiny and uncommonly smooth. The ladies held on to both his watch and pinky ring for me after they'd been removed following his recent unsuccessful surgery. And holding his ring in the flat of my hand, I remembered the square-shaped stone sparkle as he nervously gripped my upper arm as we stood dead center stage at the Berkeley Repertory Theater where I'd been performing my show Wishful Drinking. On this particular evening, my father had attended my show, accompanied by his two nurses, Sarah and Augie, and his dealer, Randy, naturally. And his little dog, Minnie. The audience applauded wildly as I stood beside my beaming father, his head hunched over and his left leg jiggling nervously. When the applause finally subsided, I leaned down to my father and whispered in his ear, "Do you want to sing If I Loved You?" I asked him this tentatively with my shoulders scrunched up high, and he began to laugh. His eyes beaming. "Of course," he replied enthusiastically. So I held my hand up in order to silence the cheering crowd and told them, "My dad and I are going to sing the song we always sang together ever since I was a little girl. It's the song If I Loved You from the show Carousel." And as the audience's clapping and cheering once more subsided, I kneeled down next to him, my face upturned to his, and with his gaze fixed tightly to mine, and after a hush no bigger than your fist, we began to sing. Face to face, voice to voice, each wound round the other, father and daughter, two voices, no waiting, one song. My father, wheelchair-bound at my side, riding the song to the end of its harmonious journey. And as the last note slowly faded back to silence, the crowd rose to its feet as one, cheering. My father sat quite still, holding my hand, seemingly absorbing his ovation. Then he began, oh so slowly, to rise until he was standing upright. Miraculously, as if he'd somehow been healed by show business, raised up to the heavens, mobile and in somehow perfect health, whole again. The crowd had loved him till he was all but immortal to his realized potential, healthy, happy, and home free. I wore the ring to his memorial on the middle finger of my right hand. His send-off was a small affair attended by his three daughters, this one mournful ex-wife, and a couple of comics. The sad gathering was naturally held in the exclusive private back room of Factors, a West Side deli located on Pico Boulevard. We all mingled beneath an array of photos of Eddie laughing with beautiful women or singing in clubs or on TV. My half-sisters periodically snuck covetous looks at Eddie's ring, glittering smugly on my hand, knowing on some secret level of the Fisher family language that it belonged to all of us, and that one day each of us would look down at our hands and there it would shine. "Oh, that's at least 5 or 6 carats," one untrained observer studying my stubby little hand told me, while another, looking doubtful, his brow furrowed seriously, volunteered, "I'd say it's 10, and I know my diamonds," prompting a third to say, "That thing is worth at least 50 grand, and I'm being conservative. I mean, who knows how much this thing could turn out to be worth?" Well, it turned out that someone did. A few weeks after this, I not quite unexpectedly found myself doing my show in Australia. And one day, while shopping in one of their malls, one afternoon in a jewelry shop specializing in fire opals, I suddenly thought, hey, who better to appraise my dad's ring than a jeweler with one of those 10x magnifying eyepiece things? At first, this particular jeweler hemmed and hawed awkwardly, a timid predator circling his distracted prey. As I watched, he turned the ring slowly, squinting at the stone, studying it carefully, turning it back and forth and back and forth. He finally spoke, still examining the gem in his hand. "This could be as much as 10 carats, he offered. My eyes widened. I looked at my friend Garrett, whose eyes also climbed northward toward his hairline and beyond to the blue Sydney skies. Suddenly, the jeweler's voice changed slightly. "Ooh, wait, hang on a tick," he suggested. And so we waited. I mean, really, what were our options? "I'm beginning to notice these... what would they be? Little chips around the edge near the center, which... well, if it were actually a diamond..." He lifted his head and gave me a look, a combination of concern, guilt, and apology. "Well, you see, if it were actually a diamond, there wouldn't be any chips at all." I hesitated, gradually absorbing this new information. And then I began slowly nodding, a smile spreading across my not-that-amazed face. "Perfect. There you go. This totally made absolute Eddie Fisher sense. Would you like to have a look?" the jeweler offered gently, holding his magnifying glass sympathetically toward me. I held up the palm of my right hand to convey my low level of need to confirm that my father's ring turned out to not be the hoped-for legacy of not quite inestimable value, but was instead 7 or 8 carats of cubic zirconium. The thing is, I love my dad. I mean, the man was beyond adorable, totally a blast to hang out with, appreciative, playful, and eccentrically sweet. He was all those things and a whole lot more. But this was also a man who, though he genuinely meant to give bona fide diamonds of only the finest color, cut, and clarity, ultimately was only able to offer cubic zirconium. But hey, a ring's a ring, however you cut it, right? I mean, carats or no, the thing sparkles. The main thing is, finally, that my dad wore this ring for years and years and years, until the end of his long, lovable, lunatic ride. So if you see any of my siblings, could you tell them about the ring not being real? I'm sorry, but I just can't seem to bring myself to bring this one last teeny bit of hilarious, exciting news. Not that I think any of them will ultimately be any more surprised than I was. I mean, there is just something so perfect, so right, so Eddie about this news. He came to me in a dream one night while I was in Sydney on tour down under with my now one and a half woman show. It was the night before my birthday, and after watching an enjoyable documentary on serial murderers, I took my meds and drifted off to sleep. I dreamt my father was alive again, and particularly wanted to let me know how pissed he was that I had his ring. Keeping my eye on the bigger picture here, I said, "But we embalmed you. How could you have survived that?" I mean, the man sounded fantastic, albeit pissed about how he'd been treated in death. Ring-wise, that is. "Tell you what," I said. "Next time, write a fucking will that gives us any kind of instruction on what you want done and who you want to do it." Then I attempted to shift gears. Where were my manners? The man was back from the dead. "Wait till you see some of your obituaries. They were totally awesome. Seriously. I mean, there was even all this stuff about you knowing presidents and everything. Elizabeth Taylor even cried when I told her." Somehow, though, none of this alleviated his irritation. I told him how glad I was that he was alive. His death had upset me so much. Then I realized that all the people who had sent me their condolences would probably write me again, wanting the details on how he had outlived death. What was his secret? I called my half-sisters, Jolie and Tricia, to tell them, but they already knew. It had been on the news. And they were en route to see him at the house I had rented for him in Berkeley. I tried and tried, but couldn't reach my brother, no matter what combination of numbers I employed. I wouldn't be able to go see him for a while, because I was in Australia doing my show. But I knew now that I would have to send him back his ring. In his later years, Eddie had come to realize that he was a very bad father. Though to his credit, unlike Harry, I don't think I ever heard him fart. His less than commendable paternal skills were never far from his mind. And you have to give him a lot of credit for acknowledging that. I know I do. I mean, he truly knew that any attention I gave him during the last few years of his life was not of a reciprocal nature. You know, it was all sort of gratis. I was caring for him not because I was expected to, but because I wanted to. 'Cause he so enjoyed my visits that it was a pleasure to give them to him. And my pleasure increased his even more. He appreciated being taken care of, and it was largely for that reason that I did it. Essentially, he truly understood that he'd really blown it with me. I mean, he'd blown it with all of his kids, but I like to think he regretted his lack of relationship with me the most. Not that that's necessarily true. It's just that it's never too late to want to be the favorite. Near the end, he was doing all he could to get to know me. Everything from hugging me tighter than any man had ever hugged me in my life, to calling me 15 times a week. I mean, if when I was young I had gotten even one of those calls a month, I would have been over the moon. I talked to him on the 4th of July, a few months before he died, from Jackson Hole, Wyoming, where I was on vacation with a few friends. And I was telling him all the stuff we were doing. River rafting and fireworks and all this other cool stuff. And when I finished, he said, "I wish I had your life." To which I replied, "You did, Daddy. That's why you're in bed." And the great thing was that he totally got it. It wasn't just something I was saying for my own amusement that whizzed over his head and that I would tell my friends about later. My dad had a real sense of humor. And on top of that, he had this huge appreciation for irony. You know, packed to the gills with a hunger for fun. Funger. The guy was loaded with it. The whole shot. When my father died, I lost something I never had. Something I sort of got in the bottom of the ninth. But by then, things were reversed. I was the parent, to the point that sometimes he even called me Mommy. But you know what? What was great was that if he loved you, and he truly did love me, maybe he especially loved me even more in his desperate state, he could make you feel that your world lit up brighter than any star, movie or otherwise. More than almost anything, this was a joyous man, which is the thing I truly realized about him right in time to lose it. But at least I had it to lose, which is in the end the thing. Somehow I'm grateful that we connected at all, because a little of him was a whole lot for me. Not really enough, of course, but a big bunch of something. I did an interview recently where I was talking about, of all things, myself. And I said that sometimes I felt like I was more a persona than a person, designed more for public than private. And I illustrated this notion with that thing Cary Grant said. Everybody wants to be Cary Grant, even me. And the interviewer said, yeah, but no one really wants to be Carrie Fisher. I mean, he said it in the nicest way possible, and I totally understood what he meant. But I said, well, you know, actually there is an area where you should want to be Carrie Fisher. Because there is something in me that is joyous, that's joyful. And I don't hate hardly ever. And when I love for miles and miles. A love so big, it should either be outlawed or it should have a capital and its own currency. And that, along with an unfortunate affinity for illegal substances and a diagnosis of manic depression, are among the many gifts bequeathed genetically by my father. The man Eddie and I forged a relationship from common characteristics that most people don't actually covet, and some of these characteristics were immaturity, forgetfulness, a perhaps unhealthy fondness for shopping, continuing to make purchases long past the point where we could afford to, and an enthusiasm for the altered state that even bordered on suicidal on occasion. Not that we went to those lengths while in one another's company, but there was an unspoken understanding that we were willing to go to any lengths in our pursuit of an absence of intense and or unwelcome feeling, i.e., the perfect high. So this is what we shared, in addition to brown eyes, good singing voices, and kidney stones. This is what we shared instead of a wealth of common experience and history. We shared a love for escape from reality, a sense that any reality one found oneself in could and should be improved. And for a long while, that was enough. Perhaps because it had to be, and partly because I finally realized that the way to have a satisfying, even fulfilling, certainly reliable and predictable relationship with my dad was for me to take care of him, to make him feel loved, appreciated, and understood. To parent my parent was the pathway to my relationship with Eddie Fisher, my old papa. Enough of a relationship to where I miss him now, a lot. And I miss him in a very different way than how I missed him throughout my childhood. Then I missed the idea of him. Now I miss the man, my dad.
Shockaholic, was written and read by Carrie Fisher. It was recorded by Mitch Linscoop and Paul Ordonez at Point 360 West in Los Angeles. Editing and post-production by Like 2,000 Pounds. The associate producer was Christina Zarapanidis. Shockaholic was directed by Matt Cartsonis and produced by Louisa Solomon. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Shockaholic is available in hardcover from Simon & Schuster. Also written by Carrie Fisher from Simon & Schuster Audio, Wishful Drinking and The Best Awful, both read by the author.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.